Hello, everyone. This is the AI Podcast. My name is Athir Ghatami, and my guest today is Wilhelm von Ehrenheim, who is CAIO at QATech. Welcome, Wilhelm.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you here. Wilhelm, what is AI?
So AI is software-based intelligence systems, right? So the problem with that definition, I guess, is that intelligence is not very well defined. But in my opinion, it's some kind of system that does detection, pattern recognition, or some kind of decisions automatically.
That sounds like a great definition to me. So, Wilhelm, you're co-founder also of QATech, which I did not mention. Please tell us, what do you do? How do you use AI? And what is the idea behind it?
So the idea behind QATech is to automate QA testing of web applications.
And QA is quality assurance.
Exactly, yeah. Right. So essentially what we do is that we develop AI agents that can do tasks on web pages. And then we use them to test functionality. So we give them objectives like buy this product or book a new plane ticket or something like that, right? And then the agent tries to accomplish that task. And then we can see if the pages are functioning as they should before going out into production.
All right. So are you currently focused on web pages or is it broader than that?
So since we're pretty early, like we decided to focus on web applications as a first step. I think it can expand to being like apps and other kinds of applications as well over time, but primarily focusing on web applications.
Yeah, I said that's a smart idea. There is always this risk that you have a startup that wants to solve everything and they do not get any customer at the end of the day. It's much better to focus at one customer at a time. So no, I like that. So, all right. So you have this agent-based approach, and I guess that it's the technology of large language models that has enabled your product. Am I right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So could you tell us a little bit more about the technology behind it? What is it that you're doing that you think is different? What is it that your customers gain from QATech that they cannot get directly from other language models? Please tell us a little bit more.
Of course. So I think, first of all, like the language models have enabled us to do more advanced agents than we could do before. They have a lot of world knowledge. They know a lot about the internet. They know a lot about code and HTML and like all of these things that makes it easier for us to structure an agent to be able to understand things. We still need to structure a lot of things, like understanding web page is not just like pasting in HTML and asking it questions, right? It needs to do a lot of things around that. So for us, it's been kind of condensing the web pages, both kind of the visual representation and the HTML representation into an understandable kind of format so that the agent can take good decisions. And then do that into some kind of decision process where it takes a lot of decisions, so like filling in different fields, clicking on buttons, and those kind of things, right?
Yeah, I fully understand. This is actually very interesting because here a lot of the heavy weight that you're lifting is actually to understand what is the data and the interface you should present to these LLMs in order to benefit, to make them understand and act in a way that actually gives you what the output that you want to get, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and this is actually not trivial because you don't know it. Probably you have done a lot of experimentation until you have reached this point where you see, okay, this is useful now.
Yeah, totally. And I think you're like a human QA engineer is also kind of learns things about the web page over time, right? They don't see it for the first time every time they go in. They know how to click different kind of menus. They know how to navigate the page and understand what happens when they start kind of filling in a form, what should happen afterwards and so forth. So I think structuring also not only the current page, but also kind of understanding a little bit more about the entire web page, scanning that and building out some kind of understanding about the product that we're testing also helps to take better decisions for the agents.
Right. So let us try to dig into details, but still as at a high level.
Yeah,
so
of course.
Just to make people to understand, if someone wants to build another product, hopefully not the QATech copy, to help them understand how you get around it. So you use an LLM, right?
Yeah.
And as you say, like you have this data, say it's HTML code or something similar. And what is, so you say, I mean, when you do this, some kind of feature engineering, what's to input into the LLM, How does the process work? Is it a lot of trial and error? Could you tell us about this journey?
I think there's always a lot of trial and error, but I think it's important to think about prompt engineering, which is essentially a kind of structuring the question to the large language model in a way so that you get expected results. It's not very different from traditional machine learning training where you have a lot of hyperparameters that you tweak. And then you want to optimize so that you get as good and stable performance as possible, right? So I think you still need to be very mindful about how you structure the problem and also not trying to do everything at the same time. So it's breaking down problems into small parts and trying to understand how you could potentially improve those individual parts and how they contribute to the larger kind of goal as individual components.
I see. I mean, is it in a way like having multiple agents trying to solve the same problem, big problem, but then it's partitioned to smaller problems?
Yeah, exactly, right. So for example, if we look at the entire HTML, like understanding everything that is available on the page is very hard, right? But if you look at some specific small kind of segment of the HTML and asking an agent, like, can you explain what this actually does to me? Then it has a much easier kind of time to understand everything because it's not too much happening at the same time. It's the same when you ask ChatGPT for an answer, right? If you ask 15 questions at the same time, it's going to have a very hard time answering it nicely. Whereas if you give it data that is relevant and ask one specific question, then it's usually very good at answering.
Right, that's a very good answer. All right, so suppose that I want to build an app. And I would come up with some simple example. I guess you're still dealing with some kind of a lot of, you know, APIs in a way. And say I want to be connected to, say, food delivery service and with their APIs. And I want to have this LLM to help me to order food from Foodora or something similar. In a scale like 1 to 10, how hard or easy is it to do that?
I think it's very easy to do a kind of proof of concept application. It's pretty easy to communicate with external APIs for an agent. You have the kind of functionality called function calling in several of these models these days that makes it even easier, where you can essentially construct different kinds of tools or functions that the agent can call as an answer instead of giving you a text answer, right? And then, but that in itself is actually just a way that they're trained to respond in a structured format. You can also ask it to answer in a structured format, say JSON, for example, that you can parse with your normal code and then send the responses to an API and then kind of feedback that into the model. So getting something up and running is usually not that hard. Making it work in a production system is usually a little bit more like challenging because you need to think a lot of different kinds of edge cases and make sure that the model handles and that responds in similar ways as you intended to, like for different kinds of things.
Right. And if you want to productify stuff, how would you get around it? Is it like you need to have gone through this journey of fine-tuning to users' behavior in order to perfect the product? Or is it possible to perfect it from the start?
I think it's totally possible. I don't think you generally need to fine-tune that much. It depends on the problem. And I think it might make it easier for you to run something faster and more efficiently if you have a lot of kind of requests. But you should be a little bit hesitant to do fine-tuning just for the sake of kind of making it better. You need to have a very clear understanding of what the structure between the input and the output should be, right? Like if there's something, what is the question that you want to answer and how do you want the model to behave? If you can construct the data set of that, then I think you can benefit from fine-tuning. Otherwise, it's usually very hard to just kind of hope that you fine-tune on the data that you have laying around and then hope that it will kind of represent what you actually want the model to do.
Right. So I have myself been involved in product development using Flutter. And as you know, Flutter can also be used for web application. I mean, we use Flutter because it's a cross-platform. And in Flutter, there are these tools that help you with the quality assurance, you know, for testing, right? You can automate testing even like input screens. So I have two questions for you. I mean, Flutter is getting very popular. So this question is really purely restricted to Flutter because that's what I know more about. In what way would your solution be easier? And if there are any important cases that you solve that these tools in Flutter cannot solve?
Super interesting. So first of all, our tool is designed to be very easy to use. You essentially only have to provide it with a URL to your staging environment or something like that, and then potentially credentials or something that we need in order to be able to authenticate. And then we automatically kind of scan your web page and understand which functionality exists and what the kind of purpose of the page is, and then construct a lot of different kinds of test cases automatically from that, so that you can then kind of get a good, better coverage than if you have to kind of prompt and make sure that you have kind of covered everything yourself. And that's usually, I mean, there has been automated testing for a long time, right? Like you have tools like Playwright and Cypress and so forth that you can use in order to kind of hard code automated tests. And I think where those tools are a little bit cumbersome to use are that because when you have hard coded a specific path, or when you have a specific solution to testing your functionality and you change something on the page, they usually break and you need to do a lot of maintenance in order to kind of make sure that you test what they actually are supposed to test as well. Again, and then our solution instead kind of can handle that out of the box. So we don't focus necessarily on the specific paths, but rather the objectives that are supposed to work. So take login, for example. We have had customers that changed login provider entirely. Like nothing looks the same, but our agent are testing whether or not it's possible to log in, and that still functions, right? So there's no need to update the test. There's no kind of overhead. There's nothing you have to do as an engineer in order to make sure that it still works to test.
Right, that's a good point. Now, that's extremely interesting because QA testing is so important. And yes, there are really good people that can test, but yeah, I've seen too many cases where it's never enough. It's always, you could release a product and discover like new bugs. They feel like, but we should have discovered that before. And it's really cool to see if we can build AI systems, you know, that can do this testing work like probably magnitudes better than humans, because of course they can do it much faster, much more efficiently, deal with complexity. The only thing I'm thinking about, yeah, I mean, for websites, I see it working. But one of the problems that you have when it comes to QA and app development, when it's cross-platform, and let's say for on mobile, is when a new operating system, an update of a new version comes up, and suddenly your login doesn't work anymore. And that's for a different reason.
Yeah.
What do you think about it? Is it still an easy problem because the changes might not have been seen by the LLM?
Oh, but I think that's perfectly fine. I think the changes don't necessarily have to be seen. Since we do, like the agents are reasoning at each step when they're kind of clicking through and doing different objectives, right? So in the case when an update comes or when there's like a different browser or something like that, that's something that is more on a kind of scaling question rather than like the LLM will be able to understand or not. So I think if we're able to run those tests on all of those different kinds of browsers and mobiles and stuff that you want to support, then that should function out of the box. We don't support that currently. We only have like one browser.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I'm just trying to see like what the next step would be, because would be amazing, you know, to have this automated testing in a more intelligent way, cross-platform, you know, coping with new, even like new changes of the operating system version, etc.
Yeah, totally.
That would be really cool. So, Wilhelm, all right. So let's get a little bit outside of the box of quality assurance. I'm pretty sure that you are an AI fantast, right? And you probably try to cope with all the developments. So much happening. I find it nowadays almost impossible to keep track of everything. I feel like I'm getting biased because the updates I get is typically from all the news. It's everywhere. And of course, you see a lot of updates in the news from the big companies who have, you know, marketing power. And I'm fully aware that that's not necessarily where, you know, the best developments happen. Yes, they do have the manpower and the resources to push it forward. But I try to stay in touch with the researchers as I do research myself and try to get the most recent. But I would like to ask you about, what are the recent developments that have caught your attention and where you see that, oh, this could be the next big thing?
It's super interesting. I think it is very hard to follow. I do agree with you. And I think there are so many different things happening. And I think especially since there's so much attention on large language models per se, like it tends to be just like, oh, this new model come out with a new set of billion parameters and it's like slightly better on some benchmark, which is still super interesting news, but it's hard to sift through everything. I think the developments that are very interesting currently are kind of increased performance in multimodality, but also new modalities as well. So you do see models that can handle time series better now. There is more kind of research and development on kind of understanding graph data as well, which I think will be super interesting. And then also you have the kind of the new models that come out with extremely large contexts and how those kind of function and how you can feed more kind of specific bespoke data to the models and make them behave and reason and understand things that are kind of closed off to the rest of the world, like within your company or within your setting that is not part of the pre-training. That's also super interesting developments, I think.
Right, right. Yeah, it's kind of amazing how the focus has quickly shifted to large language models. And it's almost like the perception of AI is being a large language model. What is your view?
Yeah, I think there is so much more interesting data that a kind of linguistic model can't really kind of handle by itself. But I think it has a lot of promise, right? We see a lot of capability and understanding in how large language models function. If you take reinforcement learning as a field, for example, it's been around for quite some time, building agents and kind of training them in different ways. But the rise of large language models makes it much more easier to kind of phrase your problem without having a lot of data. And then you can kind of get agents to behave and perform things that they couldn't really do unless you had like a lot of training data before. And it's always been a problem to, and I know this is a huge problem in robotics, for example, that to actually gather enough training data to be able to train these large models on kind of decision processes and actions and things. So I think benefiting from the world knowledge that we gain from kind of feeding them all the information we have and on the internet and everything, it has been hugely beneficial. And I think we will see the same thing with other modalities as well. You know, there is this saying with that an image says more than 1,000 words, right? I think it's so true. And I think it's also very hard to build data sets that encompasses all the kind of different things that an image could potentially portray, right? And the same comes with other modalities as well, like time series and graphs. I think if you could potentially have a large model be able to reason and understand a knowledge graph and have that as a kind of part of its input, but that would potentially close this kind of knowledge gap that we have today, where you have like you're very dependent on the pre-training or what you ever feed into the context. It would be super interesting.
Right. And I guess when you're thinking of knowledge graphs, you're thinking about dynamic knowledge graphs where you actually can change the
information. Of course, yeah.
The nodes and edges.
I mean, a graph, an image is also a graph, right? If you have a multimodal model that is trained on understanding images, you feed in the image itself dynamically. So this would be the same, but for a knowledge graph, like if it's trained on understanding knowledge graphs, graphs in general, and then you can kind of feed it in dynamically as you ask questions, and so that would be very powerful.
Yeah, because the reason I just want to clarify that is that if you just learn one static knowledge graph, yes, you will be able to see connections and reasons for the data information that you already seen, but it does not guarantee generalization and reasoning.
No, exactly. Yeah, totally. And that's kind of the same problem that you have in general with pre-training. And you want to kind of feed it a lot of interesting information in the context. And that's why we've seen kind of requests for longer and longer context length. But that's also limiting in itself because it gets to be very, very slow. Like even if you have a million or 10 million tokens as a potential context window, you're still going to be having to process that data all over. Like,
right. So what do you think about RAG as a possible solution to this issue?
I think RAG is super important. I think it's very interesting evolution. I think there is a lot of things that could be improved, and I think we'll see a lot of development in RAG kind of approaches in general. We already have, like, on the last year or 6 months has been like developing RAG quite a bit. But in general, I think when you think about how RAG functions, you have this kind of retrieval, this possibility to sift through information. But usually in the classic RAG kind of structure, you have just text chunks that are kind of disconnected from each other. If I were to ask you to search Wikipedia in this fashion, that would be super hard. Like, that would be very hard to know if it's relevant information that you get. Like if you just search by some kind of text and then you get 10 different text chunks from random articles in Wikipedia, that's going to be very, very hard. But if you kind of do that search and it's linked to an article and you can go in and you can reason about things and you can see factoids about those things and understand like the history of this article or whatever, right? Then it gets to be much more beneficial. So I think we'll see, or easy to understand, and I think we'll see systems evolving a little bit more towards that as well, where you have much more structured information and essentially search engines like for the agents or for the large language models to sift through and reason about information rather than just searching by similarity.
Right. And for the listeners, RAG stands for Retrieval Augmented Generation.
So yeah, exactly.
So yeah, now actually I'm a little bit excited about RAG because it really combines this efficient interface, human-computer interface, which is the large language model, with search, trying to, you know, get access to information that possibly the LLM does not have. But still, it could be able to understand stuff. There are some concepts that are programmed into it. And definitely, next step is that it's not only a language model, it's a multimodal system. And personally, I'm getting more and more surprised about the pace of the development. I'm starting to be in the camp where I believe that AGI is coming pretty soon. What do you think?
I mean, AGI is such a hard term. Like we talked about the definition of AI, right? And AGI just kind of amplifies that a little bit more. I think depending on who you speak to, AGI means very different things. I think when we talk about AGI as a generalist AI kind of model that can handle a lot of different kinds of problems and data, we're very close to that, I think. If we're talking about it in a more kind of just a model that can do kind of superhuman things, I don't think that's a good definition at all. And I don't think we're close to that. But when we look at these multimodal models, I think we are approaching that. And I think we'll see models that are much better at reasoning about different things now. If you ask the best models out there today about an image in different ways, you will quickly find it kind of lacking in reasoning capability or in understanding. And I think we'll definitely see those kind of gaps being filled a little bit more over time, I think.
Right. So I think there are many people who claim that most likely John McCarthy, who actually introduced the term artificial intelligence, if you would ask him or if you would ask Alan Turing, they would say, yes, AI is here.
Yeah.
We do have AI. And actually, I agree. Before, I was too much probably focused on generalization and reasoning, which is totally fine, is very important. But I still think if we would really show what we have to the founders of AI, they would probably say, yes, we have AI and it's different level, right?
That'd be blown away.
Yeah.
Like just, yeah, totally.
So it's really cool. What I think it's really interesting is, I mean, if you look at the human brain, look at the volume and all the processing power and what we can do.
Very, very, very efficient as well.
Brain
is like 10 watts or something.
Oh, yeah.
It's crazy.
So, and you cannot say that about AI today. So it feels like something is missing. I'm not sure if it's hardware issue or if algorithmic issue or most likely both. What do you think?
I think both. I mean, hardware-wise, I think even if we were, I think we could be okay with it being a little bit slow first, right? Like if it was able to reason and kind of behave more like a human. I think there are, of course, a lot of different kinds of intelligence. And I think we have already, as you said, very intelligent AI systems. But when you compare it to the human brain, it functions very differently in the sense of us being very good at picking out information and kind of storing that and making it useful kind of over time, right? So, and I think you see this a lot when you speak to people that are not very kind of used to the AI field and then say that they want to kind of have some new chatbot or something. And the assumption is always that can't you just ask the AI to read all of our internal information and understand it? Because that's not necessarily how it functions, right? A human, you could just give them a sheet of paper and they can read that and then they can kind of start talking about things. AI can do that, but only when you give it in the context, right? And then like the next call, if I haven't put it into the context, then it's completely lost. I think you have to do a lot of engineering and a lot of smart things around this system to try to mimic this reasoning and this kind of capability of learning things, which I think is super crucial to function as a human, because this is how we function. We kind of sift through information constantly and kind of pick out the important stuff.
Is learning fine-tuning?
No.
So if you have an LLM, you don't think that teaching it more stuff is about fine-tuning their weights?
No. I think that's a way to make it see things and be able to reason about things in that kind of, I mean, that corpus of things. But I think there is a difference between understanding and kind of learning patterns in the data. Like, so I think OpenAI had these examples on their dev day where they talked about kind of fine tuning, and they had an example of a company that fine tuned on Slack conversations. And then the agent started responding instead, like, "Oh, I'll give you the answer on Monday," because that's what that's what's in the corpus, right? But that's not what you think. When you fine tuning, you think that you're kind of giving it more information. Now suddenly it understands our company because it has seen all of our Slack data, but it's not really how it works. Fine tuning is not kind of teaching it stuff. It's making it try to behave like the text that you have in there, right? So then you need to be very specific about how you structure that data and make sure that it kind of has to learn the information in order to be able to answer correctly.
I really like this example. It's actually very representative of the concept of fine-tuning. So just going back a little bit more to AGI and whether it's here or it's coming, I'm gonna pose the same question but through an example.
Mm.
So what do I mean with the AGI? What I mean is that basically you mimic human behavior simply. Mm. It's not only about generating text or summarizing, etc. So take autonomous driving, right?
Mm.
It needs to have some kind of a good perception of the world and take decisions. Do you think that this is close or more far in the future? Is it 2025 or 2030?
I mean, it's usually very hard, because I think the concept of AGI needs to be kind of somewhat generalist, right? I think when it comes to being able to take decisions and kind of understand data and have a good world representation, I think you could already see this in a lot of different fields, like fraud detection. Kind of, you have a lot of different games that the AIs are able to beat humans at. I think diplomacy is one of those that are the most, you know, the system Cicero that Meta developed, right? Where it actually kind of tricks people in conversation and kind of plans things. And I think that's, if you would describe that to Alan Turing, I think he would definitely say that it's a AGI, even though he was only talking about AI, I think, at that time. But I think we'll definitely see systems where AI systems are kind of, you know, good enough to function as humans in society, like for autonomous driving. I think that's very, very close. The question is more about societal kind of structures and whether or not we're a kind of able to trust the systems well enough to let them take over kind of driving our buses and all of those things. We do already see that in a lot of places in the world, but I think we'll see a lot more in the coming years.
So I'm going to push you a little bit more. 2025, 2030.
2025.
Okay, cool. So, Wilhelm, we are nearing the end of the episode, and I have one last question for you, and is if you have any tip regarding a book, series, documentary, or a movie with AI as a topic.
I'm very nerdy, right? So I'm going to give you the tip on Understanding Deep Learning, which is a great book about like all the different kinds of deep learning methods, and that was released very recently. I think the author is called Simon Prince or something like that.
Right, right. Cool. Why this book?
I think it's beautifully written. There is a lot of nice kind of visualizations and to kind of build better understanding about the modern technology that is powering like all of these different systems. You can read about, you know, the transformers and how they function and all the attention mechanisms and those things. You can read about diffusion models and how they have evolved in order to be able to generate images in the way that we, and video and so forth, that we see today. So super interesting, very relevant, and also the kind of backstory to how this is functioning like it does today.
Super great recommendation. I will myself take a look. So Wilhelm, it has been great pleasure to host you in this episode. I really enjoyed our conversation. And I hope that we'll see you again in the podcast.
Thank you. The same. It was super nice to be here.
Thanks.